what I do suggest is take that next step, which is if where you meet discomfort is the same anywhere, we can grow our capacity to deal with it everywhere, right? You go to the gym to build your biceps, but if you want to grow your breakthrough results, your resilience, your ability to adapt, you hunt discomfort no matter what form it's in.
Welcome back to another episode of the Making Magic podcast. I'm Sean Jay, your host, and I'm a professional magician, speaker, and 3D designer. And this is all about inspiring conversations with the movers, the shakers, the visionaries, and the makers, the wizards behind the curtain that make the magic for you. Now, if this is your first time tuning into the show, thank you so much for doing so. It really does mean a lot to me because I put a lot of hard work into each and every one of these episodes. Whether you're listening to the sound of my voice on any one of the popular podcast apps or on YouTube, hopefully you'll decide, if you're a podcast type of person, that you'll follow the show. Follow me along for the ride and leave a healthy review of the show. And if you're here on YouTube, feel free to give this show a thumbs up, comment below, turn on the notification bell, and subscribe. You guys know what to do because I'm all about getting your creative gears turning, and that's what this show is all about. Whether you feel like you're stuck with a certain thought pattern and you want to break out of your current thought pattern, if you feel boxed in and trying to be inspired to think in new ways, well, I've got some of the world's most creative people that are sharing their process with you on this show. So I hope you decide to join me on the journey, and I'll be releasing episodes like every week now. So I hope you guys are enjoying this stuff. So with all that being said, let's learn a little bit more about our next guest. Hey, Sterling, welcome to the Making Magic podcast.
Hey, Sean, thanks for having me on. Good to see you.
Yes, yes, this is going to be a deep dive, a deep chat. Now, those of you who are watching the recorded version, you guys are hearing, you've already heard a little intro about Sterling, but just to recap for those watching or missed the intro, Sterling is the author of a book called Hunting Discomfort, which I actually have a copy of right here. It's an awesome book, and not only is he the author, he's also a keynote speaker and entrepreneur, and he's got a lot to say about growth and transformation and the magic of getting outside of your comfort zone. So Sterling, we're gonna start it off by sharing with my audience a story about the very first thing that you ever created in your life.
Yeah, I was into all sorts of stuff as a kid. I loved painting, drawing, assembling things. I think Legos was my favorite toy. But the first thing that I really felt like I created was, my sister got a Barbie car. I don't know, she was 3 or 4 years old, which would have made me probably 13 or 14. Brand new electric Barbie car that she was going to drive around in the backyard. And I thought, you know what? That Barbie car engine would make a great weed whacker. And I was making, I don't know, a cent a weed or a couple cents a weed with the neighbors, a couple people down the block. And so I dismantled her Barbie car and turned it into a weed whacker. She wasn't happy. My mom wasn't happy, but it did work.
Okay, okay. And what, I mean, yeah, that definitely wasn't something I would expect right off the top of the bat. But I mean, right? You took me all the way back to ground zero.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I think about making, it's a little bit like art for me. Like, I'm not a maker in the traditional sense. You know, like, I'm not welding. I'm not cutting wood. I'm not a carpenter. But I do create things. I create experiences for people. And I think in that way, you look through it in that lens, we're all kind of makers in a different way. It's just a matter of how we're looking at the world, how we're looking at the resources in front of us. And anybody that can take those things and craft something from it, whether it's a weed whacker, maybe a new wood toy or a keynote experience, it's all kind of in the same vein or thinking direction, at least in my mind.
It is. It is, because Most people don't see it that way. Most people think when they hear maker, they think taking tools, taking materials, building whatever this tangible thing is. But creating an experience, right. creating a talk, creating any one of these things is all, you use the same skills from get from point A to point B, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, I remember I had this epiphany. It was years ago. I think I was with one of my first girlfriends at a museum, and we were looking at some of the modern art and how they had put paint on the boards. And I was looking at it, I was like, I could do that. Like, that looks simple to me. And she looks at me, and she's an artist. So, you know, she had background. She went to school for it and everything else. And she's like, Sterling, that's not the point. The point is that they thought to do it like that. And it was like fireworks went off in my brain. Like, oh, that's it. It's not necessarily like I can do it too. It's having the thought in the first place. So I thought that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reason why you wanted to make this weed whacker thing? And what did you learn from making that first time?
So I was making, I think it was like a cent per weed for the neighbors' houses. We lived on a block, kind of a rural area. And I had talked them into giving a penny per weed. And I was just pulling them and counting them and charging them, whatever. And I thought, hey, this weed whacker was going to, you know, do it way better. And it did. But what I forgot about is that it's not just me that is getting value from something that I create. Again, Weed Whacker, Keynote, or anything else that anybody makes. It's really about considering the greater impact that you have. And the greater impact that I had was net negative, right? My parents were mad at me because I broke this brand new Barbie car my sister got. My sister wasn't happy because she couldn't drive the thing around. And the neighbors really didn't care. Like, for them, it wasn't how I got the weeds out. It was that I got the weeds out. So considering any invention, something that I made, from that higher level perspective of, hey, what is the greater impact here of what it takes to assemble this thing, is something that I still use even to this day.
Yeah, and that's really great that you were able to find a parallel there, which I figured you'd have no issue doing, considering your line of work. But I mean, most people don't think that way. Most people think, oh yeah, that was something fun I did when I was a kid. Nobody cares, and it didn't affect me at all. But we can all learn from those core principles, and it can inform us. And it's basically what you were doing is basic entrepreneurship. You were, the first idea was, here's another way that I can make money, or a way, a creative way. And then number two, most people probably will overlook, is the magic of scaling. Like, instead of hand picking the weeds, I can scale my efforts by changing the method of doing that, which then will bring, right. serve more people, bring more money, et cetera, et cetera.
The execution side of that was easy, you know, but the thought of going through, hey, how can I take the limited resources in front of me and put them together in a different way to get a new result is really what entrepreneurship is about. Right? How do you look at how much time you have, how much money, the relationships, whatever tools, skill sets, and how do you use that to create something that is going to provide value to yourself and the world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And based on just your life and the sequence of events, starting from the weed whacker all the way to where you are now, if you were to...
It's been quite a journey, I can tell you that.
Yeah, you've grown just a little bit since then, you know, changed a little bit.
Slightly.
If you were to go back in a magic time machine and the gears were to be turning and you were to go back... Mm-hmm. And relive your life up to the moment to where you are now. Is there anything that you would have, advice that you would have given your younger self to prevent yourself from making any of the mistakes or doing things the way you did earlier on?
It's a good question. And I think not prevent the mistakes. I think the mistakes were actually necessary for me to learn and grow in ways that I did. And I wouldn't take any of them back. But what I would adjust, and this is just a slight adjustment, is that I wouldn't feel as bad about the mistakes. I would have said, you know what, younger version of Sterling, you're going to make mistakes and it's okay. You're okay. You're going to make it through this thing. It's never the mistakes that are the problem. Like I said, I think they're critical, not just for me, but for all of us, because that's how you learn. When things don't work, it's giving you negative feedback to say, oh, I need to change, adjust, grow, whatever it is. It's when those mistakes stop you and you say, oh, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to try that again. Oh, this doesn't work entirely. That's what holds you back. And that's really the problem. And I got stuck with, you know, a fair bit of those things in the past, feeling bad about some of those missteps or mistakes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having the ability to let go of some of those things and move forward faster is the only thing I do a little differently.
Yeah. Letting go is probably one of the things that people have the most trouble with, because everybody, it was just natural. We're like naturally wired to get attached to things that we really like. And conversely, right. we're wired to repel away the things that we dislike. Like any time we're uncomfortable, anytime we have to change, anytime we have to, discomfort. That's why it's all about hunting, purposefully hunting the discomfort.
Exactly. I mean, when you get more adept at dealing with discomfort, it gives you exactly that capacity to grow even faster. I found this research at a University of Michigan. You know, you and all the listeners have felt physical discomfort before, right? Like you stubbed your toe.
Sure.
Or emotional discomfort, like maybe a project didn't go as you wanted, or you lost a big sales deal. Emotional discomfort. Mm-hmm. Turns out physical, mental, emotional, the brain and body process it almost identically. So much so you can take acetaminophen like Advil and it will help you with emotional pain. Now, all the disclaimers about that, especially since we're live, I'm not a doctor, it's not a biohack. I don't suggest anybody do that. But what I do suggest is take that next step, which is if where you meet discomfort is the same anywhere, we can grow our capacity to deal with it everywhere. Right? You go to the gym to build your biceps, but if you want to grow your breakthrough results, your resilience, your ability to adapt, you hunt discomfort no matter what form it's in.
No matter what, hashtag.
No matter what.
Exactly. I'm trying to help you out here. No, but it's true though. And it's just like the gym. If you don't go to the gym, your muscles shrink. If you don't seek discomfort, your level for tolerance, if it's like a loading bar or a health bar in a video game, it just the less you use it, the more it just goes away.
Yeah, no question. And as human beings, we tend to really focus on and pin our value to specific tangible things. Like I have this much money in the bank. I have these kinds of relationships. I have this business. I've had these successes, which is all great, at least until you don't have some of those things. And what's really more important to human beings is not those physical things. The German-American theologian and philosopher Paul Tillich would say, well, we spend most of our time worried about those finite things. What's most important to human beings is infinite things like love, joy, gratitude, and peace. And when we really bring ourselves into that love in the face of a failure or gratitude in the face of a loss, that's what's going to start transforming everything in your way. And that's really a capacity to build that hunting discomfort muscle. So no matter what happens, you've built the belief inside of yourself that you're ready to deal with it. Again, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Nice. All well said. So regardless of whatever setbacks and things that are on your plate, Sterling, what is the most recent thing that you've created, no matter what, despite all the other stuff clawing at your door?
You showed it earlier.
Hey, look. Okay, this is it.
Yeah, right. That's it.
How'd you do that?
Yeah, I've spent most of my career in the knowledge business world, right? Consulting, working with different people, companies, making slide presentations, putting proposals together. And when I got this book in the mail, it was one of the first things, at least in my adult life, that I opened. I was like, I made this. Of course, other people printed it, and I had hundreds, if not thousands of people help me put this thing together. Mm-hmm. But it was really a very visceral experience of taking it out and realizing all that work I had spent on the computer, the hours in the morning, at nights, the long weekends, whatever it was, turned into this book. And it was really an incredible experience.
Yeah. And I'm sure you learned a lot of lessons making it too.
No doubt. Well, so it's funny enough, I, in retrospect anyways, avoided writing a book. I mean, I've been speaking for, 5-6 years, somewhere in there. And people told me right from the beginning, Sterling, you got to write a book. This is fantastic. Where's your book? Like, can I buy the more detailed version of whatever you're speaking about on the stage or consulting with us about? And my answer was always like, oh, well, yeah, at some point, but I'm too busy. And then the pandemic struck. All the business totally gone in a period of about a week. Every keynote, workshop, everything we had on the books was canceled or indefinitely delayed. And for a while, I felt beat up about it. And then I started looking at my calendar and all the free space that I had. And I was like, huh, I have this time and I'm still not writing. There's something else at play here. And, you know, there's things that stop all of us, avoiding, denying, or just surviving something. I call those the three discomfort defaults. And even as a teacher, a purveyor, a writer about these things, it stopped me. And I didn't even realize it because I didn't slow down enough to kind of take it into myself to be like, oh, yeah, this is just something that you're avoiding. But as soon as I realized it, I started talking to different publishers. And I did what I think everybody should do in the face of discomfort, especially discomfort that stops you from doing something you really want, which I committed. I committed in a way where there was no going back. It's actually the second step in the book. I call it get a tattoo, not a real tattoo, but look for ways where you can commit, put yourself on the line where you don't have any choice but to move forward. And when you have commitments that are bigger than your discomfort, that's what's going to call you through to new results. And having the book, the physical proof, is that it does work. Worked for me, works for everybody, individuals or companies.
It's just like skydiving, you know? For half of it is probably getting yourself to agree to the act of doing it. And then the other half is actually getting on that plane and just forgetting everything. You're just push preconceptions out the window, no pun intended, and take a step out the window yourself.
Exactly.
Just trust process.
Well, what's important, I think, in that, writing a book, any new goals that people have, is differentiating between discomfort and real danger, right? Skydiving, for example. Have you been skydiving before, by the way?
No, but it's on my list.
Yeah. Well, so I've been once, and I went with my sister. It was her birthday a couple of years back, and she's like, Sterling, let's go skydiving. And as the no matter what guy, I was like, okay, let's do this thing. Okay. And I candidly was terrified. You know, you got to sign all these waivers. You had to get in front of a video and say, hey, I'm doing this on my own accord. Nobody's like pushing me into it. And you jump out of the plane, and it's, like I said, it is terrifying. But doing a little research after the fact, I found out that the car drive over there was far, far more dangerous, like 100 times more dangerous than jumping out of the plane. And it was this real epiphany of, well, wait a minute. What we feel discomfort with is not always actually dangerous. And as we can look through that discomfort and understand the physics, the mechanics, the real risks of whatever situation that you're stepping into, you're just going to make much better decisions because you're oriented to what's actually happening, not necessarily just how you feel about it, which inevitably is probably off.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say that's a great point about being in the car rides more dangerous. And I think there are other things too, that are just as dangerous. I think people can get in accidents just in the kitchen, you know, like actually, I have a really crazy example. So there's this photographer who is unfortunately no longer with us, the late, great, his name is Peter B. Kaplan. For those of you who have not heard of Peter's work, he was the original, he was doing height photography before drones existed. He was doing and going where drones would go with his own self. He would climb. Like, he would take pictures of the Empire State Building or the World Trade Center. I believe there was, one of the World Trade Center when it was up. He got to the top and then got some professionals to rig him up. So his body was physically like on some kind of climbing rig on the needle of one of the Twin Towers. So he himself can be there with the camera off the side taking a shot of the whole city or getting that fisheye view. You know, humans would not really think to do that today. But where I was going with this is he did this for years, like 30 some years, had a great career. And then towards the end of his life, he injured himself severely, injured his back by climbing a 3-foot ladder to change his birdhouse in his backyard.
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, a lot of the things out in the world seem dangerous, like publishing a book, starting a business, maybe getting on stage and doing a new magic trick, right? Like there's a lot of discomfort in there, but it's, I think, important for all of us to kind of step back for a moment and be like, well, listen, there's all these dangers around me every day that I just have built the capacity for. Like, I'm not scared every time I get in a car. I'm not scared when I get on a 3-foot ladder. Why should I be scared of some of these other things that, when you look at the mechanics or the specifics of the real dangers, are far less dangerous than the things you do every day?
Right. Something to keep in mind. Yeah. Everybody should be, just remember this. This is very important. Now, out of the skills and the tool sets that you possess, Sterling, what would you say is your best asset as far as who you are as a creator? Meaning, some people are best at writing. Some people are best at this aspect. Some people building, getting teams together, hiring people.
I think it's creating experiences and everything that goes into that. Which is writing, it's stage setup, it's lighting, it's music, it's the pictures that are actually on the slides, the videos that we use, putting those things together that are going to do two things. One is deliver oftentimes the 5 no matter what steps, what's actually in the system, delivering the information. And that's important, but I think where that experience piece comes in is delivering that in a way where it really leaves people touched and inspired. And that's the second thing, inspiring people. So not only like they know what to do, but they've got some interest, a fire burning inside them that leaves them wanting to get up and go do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's so many different ways a person can do a motivational speech or inspirational speech, however you want to frame that. Yeah. But to get people to actually, like what you said, to get people to actually move on that info or on that subject, that's the real trick there, and to inspire lasting change.
I think so. And I do have a differentiation between motivation and inspiration. Richard Condon, one of my friends and mentors, he says motivation is getting yourself or somebody else to do something they don't really want to do. And there's a time and a place for that, for sure. But inspiration is something that's not externally motivated. It's coming from inside of yourself. There's some purpose, maybe a why inside of you that's calling you forward. And when I can, or even when individuals can themselves connect with that, it leaves them taking action even in the face of the unknown, the scary, the things they're fearful of, because something inside of them is driving. It's not based on the circumstances of the world. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. An internal driving force rather than an external crank arm or leverage bar just cranking you over the edge.
Yeah. And a lot of times people look at my book or, you know, just glance at some of my stuff and be like, Sterling, you got to look at my bank account, look at my relationships, look at my business. I don't need to hunt discomfort. I'm surrounded by it. My answer is always the same, which is you're not hunting discomfort. You're living with it and probably rationalizing why you have it, why you have to live with these situations, these circumstances the way they are. When you hunt discomfort, you're forever free of it. You're not circumstantially free, like not when you make enough money or have the right relationship or have grown to a certain level, but you're free based on only yourself. And when you're free in that way, it leaves you just very organically connected with your purpose, those internal drivers that are going to move you forward. And that's what hunting discomfort's really about.
It reminds me of what Wim Hof said. You know Wim Hof? The Iceman from the Netherlands. For those of you who aren't aware, he's just promoting the proper breathing technique. And it reminds me of when people ask him, they ask him the question, do you ever get a cold? And his answer is, I never get one because I go to the cold.
Yeah, exactly.
He purposely seeks it out so you know every single part about whatever this discomfort is, and you know ways to work around it rather than totally avoiding it and staying fresh to it every time. It's like this big freak out every single time because you've been pushing it out of your life.
Yeah. Well, I think if you're not hunting discomfort, to your point with Wim, it's hunting you. And it's only so long you can avoid it, deny it, or survive it until it's going to grow so out of proportion that you're not going to have a choice. And by the way, I learned that the hard way. I spent a lot of my early life, especially early professional life, trying to avoid that discomfort because I mistakenly thought, if I avoid it, I don't have to feel it. Well, the dirty little secret about that is nobody can avoid it. You can only avoid it for some period of time. The only two kinds of people that get to avoid discomfort entirely are either dead or not born yet. And that's nobody here. What we're left with is, how do you want to handle that discomfort? Do you want to put it off, sweep it under the rug, pretend it's not there until you're dealing with a massive emergency? Yeah. Or like Wim, do you want to go to the cold? Do you want to go to those things when they're small? They might be uncomfortable. They might be really uncomfortable. But if you go to those things when they're small, then they don't have a chance to get bigger. And you get better at dealing with it. It goes back to that muscle. You get better every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he also talks about with cold exposure, starting small and starting with a little bit, yeah, and then gradually increasing the amount of minutes that you are able to tolerate. So same thing with hunting discomfort. I would venture to guess that in the book, I didn't dig into it deep enough to make an informed comment on it, but I would assume that it's like you do a little bit. You make yourself a little bit uncomfortable. And
right.
Next time a little more. And then before you know it, you're completely made this radical change.
Right. Well, and to what we were talking about earlier, physical, mental, emotional discomfort is all the same. So cold is included, right? There's a reason that Wim and all of his followers, including myself, by the way, because I've gotten into all this cold therapy thing, find that it works. It's because where you meet discomfort anywhere grows your capacity to deal with it everywhere. So you take that cold shower in the morning or sit in the ice bath for 5 minutes. Well, that's going to give you a little more resolve in that first meeting of your day to maybe speak your mind or share things that haven't been shared before. And then when you do that, you're going to be, well, maybe I'm a little more motivated to go to the gym today, right? And you're a little more motivated to the gym. And then it's going to have this ripple effect throughout your day. And not just throughout your day, but through about the week, month, year. You get stronger every time you go after it. It's just a decision. I don't know about you, Sean, but I typically wake up avoiding discomfort. Like snooze button, right? And then I feel a little tired, boom, coffee. And then I'm looking at the stairs to the office, boom, elevator. And the whole day is just a series of choices of, okay, am I going to lean into discomfort or am I going to kind of sit back in the comfort and certainty that I already know? And the trick is, for myself included, is catching it. Oh, I'm hitting the snooze button again. Oh, I'm not speaking up when I want to say something. And when you catch it, then you've got some power of choice, some autonomy to do something about it. And that's where, whether it's in your day or your life, your work, wherever you're looking at it, you can start to lean into discomfort for growth.
Right. And it's also about asking yourself the question, like having an honest conversation with yourself, yeah, like saying, okay, I want X result. So obviously it's not going to happen if I keep doing the same thing that I'm doing. This is what I have to do. Mm-hmm. It most likely sucks when you first start doing whatever it is because it's something that you don't know, have no experience with. But the results, right, if you hang in there, well, that's where the gold is.
Totally. And I think it's worth taking a step even further back from that. You know, I think most people kind of understand that correlation of, if I want X result, I have to take Y action, right? If I want to lose weight, I got to go to the gym or I've got to change my diet, right? There's a very clear correlation there. But taking a step further back, you start to look at, what beliefs do you have that are driving those actions? Because there's beliefs you have about one of three things: yourself, others, or the world, that have you take the actions that you take. And as you can start to shift that lens of belief of how I see myself or how I see others or how I see the world, that's going to leave you acting different, and that's going to naturally give rise to new results. I think when you get too much into this like hyper discipline mode, there's a place for discipline, to be very clear. It's necessary. But if it's only in discipline, you start to burn yourself out because you're working with a fixed set of beliefs. When you shift those beliefs of how you see things, that gives you a little more freedom to make those actions and to have that discipline in a much more sustainable way.
Mm. And when you say discipline can be limiting, you mean by saying creating a framework and then locking into it and then just sticking to it out of the sheer desperation for discipline and then completely missing the opportunities for change or growth because you've just like the horse with the blinders and you're missing out.
Could be, for sure. Yeah. And I think there is a time and place to lock yourself into something, like no matter what, I'm mm-hmm. going to, you know, run every day this week for sure. But it's stepping back from that to say, okay, if I don't feel like getting out of bed tomorrow, why? Like at a very deep level, do I feel like maybe it's impossible for me to finish a marathon? Do I feel like it's not worthwhile to lose the weight I want to lose? And by the way, we're just talking about health here because it's very easy to see. It's kind of an easy correlate, but it Sure. applies to everything, right? Like if I don't start that business tomorrow, why? Is it because I'm scared? Because I don't know? Because I'm worried what it'll look like if it will fail? And when you step back and get into those beliefs, which can be somewhat disorienting, especially if they're axiomatic or core beliefs to who you think you are and how you're interacting with the world, it really takes getting into some of those things, destabilizing yourself a little bit at a human level, and then starting to take some new actions from there.
Yeah, because then if you don't, you can get caught up in just dogma and dogma that you yourself create. And then it's like, oh, these are my right. rules that I've created for myself. But without stepping outside, you might have created a set of limiting rules and beliefs that you think are helping.
Right. Yeah, for sure. They've helped you get to whatever point that you're at, but they yeah. just might be holding you back now. They're no longer the most effective beliefs or structure to be working with it.
Exactly. Sure. Okay. Now, what about we talked about what you've created recently, the hunting discomfort and the whole
yeah.
backstory behind that. What about something, a favorite creation of yours from the past, like one of Sterling's greatest hits from the past that you can put your finger on and you're like,
greatest hits. Well, I did. I started a company with my dad right out of college that we sold to a group in Silicon Valley. And early on, I did think that was our greatest hit. I mean, it turned into this conglomerate that we had sold into, became the Apple Pay before Apple Pay.
Oh, okay.
And we raised over $550 million, multi-billion dollar valuation. And, you know, it was crazy, Sean. I'm in my early 20s at the time. And we've got 700 people, offices all over the world. And wow. Have you seen that movie, Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah.
It was a little bit like a scene out of that movie, like models in the office, parties at the Four Seasons. I'll leave the rest to your imagination. You kind of get the point, right?
Yep.
And I really did think, like, this is a hit of a lifetime. Whether I'm really smart or I just got lucky, it doesn't matter. But this thing's going to go public. I'm going to cash in, and I'm going to crown myself this next Steve Jobs. Like, that's what it felt like. Hugely successful at the time, but long story short, and anybody that checks out the book will hear the story in much more detail. When the housing market collapsed, our investment dried up, and the whole thing ended up going bankrupt. So, like I said, it was quite a ride.
That is the whole point about, again, that was what you thought that framework was going to be the one that worked, but then totally being blind to all the other possibilities. All the eggs were in one right. basket, and then stuff happens, hits the fan.
Yeah.
Wow. What about, this may fall under the same category of this next question that I was going to ask, is what would you consider to be your biggest DIY fail of all time? Would that be that number one
Well, that or? From a business side, for sure. I'm also looking at a TV on the wall over here where my stud finder wasn't working. So there's about 18 holes behind the TV, many of which I didn't use to actually hang it.
Okay.
So I've got a variety, business failures, hanging TV failures, everything in between. But I don't know. I think the point is that you try. Like, I've learned, hey, hanging TVs, it's not my specialty. And from business, it was a different learning. It wasn't, hey, I'm not good at business. Although that was my takeaway for a while. It became a belief because I had proof for it. Hey, maybe I'm not cut out for this whole business world. But rather, it was getting more into the details and understanding what exactly I did wrong, how we could have adjusted, changed, improved. That really was, again, going back to the beginning, it was those failures that have given rise to any level of success that maybe we've seen today, and of course, transferred to different clients that we've worked with.
Okay. What about something that you created by accident? So you were working on something, you were tinkering with something, and then all of a sudden it just worked out really well, and then you've kept it that way ever since.
So this kind of is on the tail end of the big business crash and failures. Mm-hmm. And not only did I no longer have a job, but eventually I ran out of cash, and I ended up playing out the sad country song of a story where I go from the penthouse to my parents' house. My girlfriend breaks up with me. I'm in six figures of debt. Like, I had nothing. And my mom said this thing that came back to me at the time. She said, "The way out is through." It's Robert Frost, but to me, it'll always be my mom. And at the time, I was like, okay, well, like, I've got nothing to lose. Let's put this thing to the test. And to me, it means go through the hard things, the things you're fearful of, the things that you're embarrassed about. What you're looking for is on the other side. And the biggest thing for me that I was scared of at the time, believe it or not, given my profession today, was public speaking.
Huh.
I'm one of the many that would rather be in the coffin than giving the eulogy any day of the week. And it was because I had sunken into some of those limiting and false beliefs of, I'm not good at business and I don't know what I'm doing. And if I do it again, I'm just going to fail again. And having that kind of failure on my resume left me, yeah, I was already kind of shy, but left me completely debilitated in front of people and certainly crowds. Mm. And so I decided to take this thing on. The way out is through. Like, okay, Mom, let's try this thing out. And I applied to speak at a conference in Singapore. And I think it must have been because I didn't have anything to lose, Sean. But I end up talking the conference director into having me not as like a breakout random speaker, but the keynote speaker of their conference. And it wasn't until he sent me the legal agreement that it kind of lands with me how serious this is. And again, I took that important step of committing. I signed that legal agreement as fast as I could before self-doubt stopped me, and I sent it back. So she said, the way out is through. And I decide, okay, I'm going to put this thing to the test. And to me, what it means is go through what you're fearful of, what you're scared of, what you're embarrassed about, what you're looking for is on the other side. And what I was most scared of was public speaking. Believe it or not, given my profession today, like, I'd rather be in the coffin than giving the eulogy any day of the week. And so I get this just kind of a junk email, an email inviting me to a conference as an attendee. And I say, okay, I'm going to put this way out is through thing to the test. And I hit reply. I say, why don't you have me speak? Best Sterling. I still have the email. Well, I end up getting on the phone with the conference director, somehow talk him into not being a breakout speaker, but the main keynote speaker at his event.
Ha, that's
and great. I practice like a crazy person. Like, I'm obsessing about it. I didn't have a job, didn't really have much else to do. So all I did was rewrite and practice and create slides. And when the day finally came, it's a good thing I practiced, because I think I blacked out. I don't remember giving that talk.
Really?
Yeah, like, it was all a blur to me. Like, I was hot. I could feel my heart beating. My hands were sweaty. Like, if you imagine yourself in a position where you feel like the utmost discomfort, like, could not be more uncomfortable. That's how I felt.
Mm.
And I thought I bombed. And so I get off the stage and trying to make my way to the exit before anybody says anything to me, kind of cover my eyes. And the conference director catches up with me and he goes, Sterling, that's the best talk I've seen in my 17 years or something of doing this. Now, I couldn't believe it. And by the way, to this day, I don't think he was in the same talk that I was in. I think he wanted to just say something nice to me. But he did go on to put me in touch with all of his conference director friends. And I had the, at least the beginnings, kind of the seedling of the career that I have today. I was like, well, my mom was right. The way out is through. We just have to go through no matter what. And just from kind of tinkering around with that statement, that philosophy, it really turned my whole life around and became the foundation of everything that I'm doing today.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful. That's kind of similar to, sort of similar to my story about how I got into performing as a performer, magician. Magician first, speaker second. And I was terrified of people. And this was when I was 12 years old. And I was in school and I just happened to come across the sleight of hand magic. I enjoyed it as the art form. I enjoyed the entertainment value that it would bring. And I was absolutely terrified. Didn't want to. All this practice that I've done, I couldn't even share it, what I was doing with people. And then I had to just tell myself, like, if this is the career that you really want, if this is something that you want to do, you have to figure out a way to stand up in front of those people, whether you like it or not, and just try it. Just try it once. Just try it once. You're not going to die. You're gonna be okay. No, so nobody died. And I had a very similar, palpitations, a crazy amount of sweating, cold sweat.
Uh-huh.
And the more you do it, the less you sweat, the less your heart palpitates. And generally speaking, right, the more prepared you are, the less all that stuff happens.
Yeah. No question. And two things. One is that's kind of the difference between discomfort and danger again, right? Like you feel physically like the world is ending.
Yeah.
Like, just get me out of here. Yeah. I'm scared. I need to run. But there's really no danger there. To your point, like you didn't die. Nobody died. Everybody's fine, right? Like you probably remember that moment much more clearly than everybody that was in the audience.
Right.
Or anybody that was there. Right. And the second piece is, you go through that discomfort, and whether you meet it up on a stage or you meet it in a cold bath or you meet it skydiving, you're getting better. You're creating the internal tools, systems, processes. How you're thinking about and processing these things gets better every time you do it. Not to sound like a broken record, but where you meet it anywhere, it grows your capacity to deal with it everywhere. I was talking to somebody the other day and he was like, Sterling, I know exactly what I need to do, but I'm just not doing it. Every day I get up, I tell myself I'm going to make this phone call and I don't. I said, okay, well, one, you can go kind of the hardline approach of having somebody hold you accountable and make a big commitment somehow that forces you to do it. That's one way. But the other way is find discomfort somewhere else, like take an ice bath that morning and see if that frees you up a little bit to go after whatever that discomfort was, in his case, making that particular phone call. So really leverage that discomfort in any way you can. And if you find yourself not going down the path that you know you need to go down, shake yourself up in another way, and it'll free you to be able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it sets an example. It's like a precedent for the future. And then your body hopefully remembers that and goes, oh, yeah, it's okay. It's just one of those, rather than not a lion chasing me in the jungle, like primitive amygdala brain wants us to believe anything uncomfortable.
Exactly.
Right. It automatically gets put in that lion's chasing me thing. And it's good. It's better to, learn, the more of these experiences you put yourself through, the more you're able to selectively weed out the ones that really don't matter as much.
Just real quick, because I think this is interesting. I always love like the research and the brain science and philosophy, like why these things work the way that they do. When you make a commitment, it actually triggers a mechanism in your brain called the reticular activating system, the RAS, R-A-S for short. And before you commit, it's looking for outs. It's looking for ways to survive. It's looking for reasons why you shouldn't do it. It's like auto-tuned for survival. Well, when you commit, you tell your brain, like, we don't have a choice. We're going in this direction. It retunes that RAS, which is kind of like a bouncer between your unconscious and conscious mind, telling your conscious mind what's important. It retunes that RAS to look for new openings for action, new partnerships, new collaborations, new action that you can take. But before you commit, you actually can't see it. It'll be invisible from where you are sitting today. That's why that commitment's so important.
Mm. Yeah, the commitment, and then people also just the classic writing your goals out and sticking them on the wall is a level, some type of level of commitment that puts you literally the pen to the paper and puts it on like a, makes a record of that. And I guess until you make some kind of record, it vanishes into the ether with everything else that your body just wants to push out of your uncomfortable zone and into your lock, bounce you back into comfortable again.
Right. And the more places and more ways you can kind of take yourself out of that, let's just call it a rut for purposes of our conversation, the better. And again, I'm not advocating anybody live an uncomfortable life. I'm suggesting just the opposite. But you have to go through that discomfort of being, you know, called to the mat, being held accountable, seeing that goal you have posted up on the wall again and again and again, because that's ultimately, one, going to get you the results that you want, which I would say are probably going to be comfortable for you. At least you'll be happy and joyful about it. And two, it's going to be the mechanism through which it gets you there. You know, I'd love to wish everybody a happy and comfortable life. And I do, by the way. Like, I don't wish discomfort on anybody. It just happens to be, for whatever reason, to be the mechanism through which humans grow. It's inescapable and unavoidable. When we open up to it, we go through it. All those things that we want in our career, in our business, in our relationships, it's right there. We just have to be willing to do it.
Mm. That begs the question then, Sterling, what inspired you to be a maker of these experiences? Creating these transformational experiences, and who inspired you, if there was a who? And then lastly, who do you look up to in this growth, transformation, innovation space that you're in?
Well, there've been a lot of people through my life and through my career, and my mom's been really important to me. I mean, not only was she the one that said the way out is through, and she said a lot of things when I was a kid. That's just the one that happened to stand out to me. But she's always been, well, I call her my number one fan. Like, she's been supportive of me even through those massive failures. And, you know, it's the inspiration that I get from her, all that she's done in her life, the hardships that she's been through, that I think motivates me, or better said, inspires me to do some of the things that I'm doing now. No doubt about it. So not only do I look up to her and both my parents, and, you know, I've got three siblings and I look up to all of them in different ways. But I've got a lot of people in the speaking space that I look up to, like Josh Linkner, Ryan Estes, Ben Nempton, Mel Robbins, folks that I kind of look at as peers and say, you know, you're doing something in a way that's really making a massive impact. What can I learn from you, and how can we grow together, and how can I contribute to you to make whatever impact you're creating even bigger, and get a little piece of that for myself as well.
Mm. It helps to have that team, those people that inspire you rather than motivate you.
Exactly. Exactly. I think, you know, if you look at the people that you surround yourself with, like, yeah, there's that old saying that you get the average of the results from the five people that you spend the most time with. And I think that's probably true. But within those people, you want to make sure you've got somebody that holds you accountable, somebody that inspires you, somebody that can mentor you, like tactically they've done what it is that you want to do, and somebody that can love and accept you for any of the peaks and valleys on the way. Not romantic love necessarily, but somebody that accepts you at a human level.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, that's all really good. And what resources besides this great book, would you be able to recommend to my viewers and listeners to get them thinking more on this path of hunting discomfort and expanding their creativity?
I'll give you a couple of things. One is, we've got up on the website, maybe we can link it here somewhere, the Hunting Discomfort Quiz.
Okay.
And it's based on the premise of, what's in your way is not more money or more time or different relationships. The one thing fundamentally standing in your way is discomfort. And there are five major discomforts that stop all of us. One rises to the top, but it's within one of five. And the quiz, it doesn't cost anything. 15 questions takes a couple of minutes, but it's going to give you two things. One is, what of those five discomforts is the one that's stopping you? And it's not always obvious. And second, it's going to give you a pathway of what to do about it. So I'd encourage anybody to check that out and see what it is that's standing in your way and where you can go with it. The second thing, going back to what we were talking about in the beginning, is discomfort alone is not enough. It's not really about just living an uncomfortable life or feeling uncomfortable. It's opening to it. It's learning from it. And one of the best tools I've seen in that regard is a book called The Presence Process by Michael Brown. And I've done thousands, if not tens of thousands, of self-development courses over the years, and his book does a phenomenal job putting a lot of that into a very concise, understandable couple of pages in his book, and he gives you 10 weeks of meditation along with it. So highly recommend both those things.
So the quiz is at, what is the website, the URL again?
You could just go to huntingdiscomfort.com.
Huntingdiscomfort.com. You guys can go. There's a link below. And then also, the name of the book was The Presence Process. Is that correct?
That's right, Michael Brown.
The Presence Process by Michael Brown. Not like Christmas presents, but presents with an PRESENSE. Yeah, that
Present
presence.
presence, like you're here. Yeah.
Yes, like I feel your presence. Exactly. Okay. Perfect. Great,
Exactly.
Sterling. And finally, where can more of the viewers and listeners learn more about the legend that is Sterling Hawkins?
Oh, you're too kind. Thanks for that. Well, one, it's really been an honor and a pleasure to have joined you today. So thanks for having me on.
Absolutely.
But anybody that wants to learn anything about us and what we're doing, probably that same link would suffice. Huntingdiscomfort.com. You can see all about the speaking, the work we do with people, with companies. You can learn about the No Matter What community. And of course, if I can help anybody that's listening in, best way is to find me there.
Okay, huntingdiscomfort.com, guys. You heard it first. You heard it here on the Making Magic podcast. And Sterling, it's been an absolute pleasure having you join me, take some time out of your busy day to hop on this platform to inspire my audience to get their creative gears turning, starting off by hunting discomfort in their life and in their business. So, you guys have been watching and listening to another episode of the Making Magic podcast. If you're just listening to the sound of our voices on any one of the popular podcast apps, feel free to follow the show. Follow me for the ride. I interview great, amazing, creative thought leaders like Sterling Hawkins to get your creative gears turning. And if you're just watching this video on YouTube, feel free to hit the thumbs up, subscribe, turn on the notifications. You guys know what to do. That's how it works, so we can get this show out and get this message out to as many people as possible. Because I don't want you guys to feel boxed in by one level of thinking, one limiting dogma, like we were talking about here in today's episode. So expand your mind, get out there, go hunt some discomfort, and follow us along with the Make Magic podcast. So we'll see you guys on the next episode.